She's going to be talking today on learning from the past to create a sustainable future.
Good morning, and thank you again for sort of asking me to speak. I'm going to be talking about how we can use Cornwall's unique historical past to provide pointers to policymakers in creating a sustainable future. I am a trustee of Cornwall Heritage Trust, but I would like to state that my views are my personal views that I'm expressing, and I'm not actually speaking on behalf of Cornwall Heritage Trust. I will be mentioning some of the work we do, and if you'd like to learn more, there's our annual review, which is a very readable document, and please feel free to take a copy. Cornwall Heritage Trust was formed in 1985 by a few very sort of inspirational men and women who wanted to protect some of the iconic sites of Cornwall, sites that they thought were at risk, such as the magnificent Trifry Viaduct, Castle and Dynas, Sancrey Beacon, and so on. But in more recent years, Cornwall Heritage Trust has become a facilitator. It provides grants for other heritage organisations to continue with their really good work, and education is a really important aspect of the Trust's work now, and we've been working with the Institute of Cornish Studies to produce some new education projects. And we also provide bursaries for the University of Exeter students as well. Oh, thank you.
It's just that one.
Just that one.
Yeah.
Well, like Edwina, I'm going to explore what exactly sustainability actually means. And it's such a huge subject, the sustainable future, that I'm going to concentrate on culture and community. And I think Cornwall Council have been really good in creating a portfolio which brings economic development and culture together, because I think in the past culture has been very much the poor relation. And then I want to look at how the heritage sector can actually help develop a sustainable Cornwall, and then the challenges for the heritage sector and how we might overcome some of the issues. Right, Edwina gave a sort of definition of sustainable community, and it's a slightly different one. It's from the Geographical Association and Academy for Sustainable Communities. I have to read that, Mr. Long. But they've written extensively as well on their view of a sustainable community. But it's one basically where people want to live and work, and now and in the future. And the important thing is they have a huge, strong sense of belonging, place and identity. And that identity takes many forms, from your family roots, your accent, your work environment and your locality. And you may think of yourself as Cornish, but you may also consider yourself to belong to Cornwall. For instance, people that have moved down here, they may not have been born in Cornwall, but they can still have a great affinity for Cornish heritage and its spirituality. There's also a hierarchy of community identity, so that, for instance, you may have strong allegiance to a local rugby team like Camborne, but when Cornwall are playing, your allegiance would be to that team, even if it was made up of Red Roof boys. The future sustainability of a community depends on creating and maintaining its economic and environmental health, promoting social equity, and fostering broad-based citizen participation in planning and implementation. And since the 70s, social scientists have been arguing that communities should also embrace the cultural turn to ensure a vibrant and thriving future. And as we'll see in a moment, there is a good example of a community in Cornwall which has gone from being a very non-sustainable community to a very sustainable community. And in fact, Edwina and I were talking just now about another community as well that we're both from, because I'm from Loo as well. Yes, I've got to pass on. Right. This is what I did in my MA in Cornish Studies, because actually my PhD is in engineering, so I'm a bit of a fraud standing here talking about history, really. But one of the things we learnt in the MA was to distinguish between community and society, and the great sort of German sociologist and philosopher Ferdinand Tonnes actually sort of defined the two different things. And I thought it's interesting to notice how much some parts of Cornwall are moving towards society, away from a community, and especially when in-migration has meant dilution of families, family ties, and also, as we know, the churches are getting less frequented. But nevertheless, there's an awful lot of parts of Cornwall which are definitely community. And I've already mentioned that communities with a strong sense of identity are very resilient. And in times of depression, those are the society, well, communities that are going to resurge. And I think an excellent example of this is Newlyn. And this is a screenshot of Through the Gaps, which is a Newlyn blog and very vibrant. And I don't know, it was on the television a couple of nights ago on Spotlight because they've just raised a huge amount of money for the Fisherman's Mission there. But in the 1930s, the depression saw off much of the fishing fleet in Newlyn. The fishing fleet in the early 20th century were family-run and relied on sail. They were totally ill-equipped to compete with the large company steamboats. Much of the fleet was just broken up, and with the slum clearances of the 30s, the heart of Newlyn was also largely destroyed. And in 1910, we see that the sort of annual fish catch was worth about £20,000, but by 1918, it was only worth about £10,000. And there's a huge decline in the fishing industry. And in fact, my great-grandfather, who had a very thriving fishing boat in the sort of turn of the century, by 1914, the boat had been sort of scrapped. Yet Newlyn now is very resurgent. It's one of the largest fishing ports in the UK. It has plans for even more expansion and has a very successful fish festival and community atmosphere. Unlike the more attractive Mousel, the heart of the town has not fallen prey to empty second homes. Research from Dalby and McKenzie in 1997 illustrated how the understanding of past conflicts can inform current and future social policy-making decisions. So let's look at the history of Newlyn and its neighbour Penzance and how we can learn from this. In the 1890s, the Mounts Bay was awash with fishing boats. Seine fishing, and both local and from the east coast of Britain as well. So it was a mixture of Lowestoft boats, Great Yarmouth, and Newlyn, Mousel, Porthleven boats. There's a very poor community. In fact, this is Newlyn on the right. In fact, if you spot some family likeness, that's my great-great-grandfather, and that's my great-grandfather. And it's right next to the more vibrant, prosperous Penzance, which by 1866 was able to send goods to London direct with the opening of the Broad Gauge Railway and the Royal Albert Bridge. And you can see the promenaders and Newlyn just literally down the road, very different. So there are adjacent communities. Life in Newlyn was pretty hard. The economy centred on a very short mackerel and pilchard season, only around 3 months. The Newlyn fishermen refused to fish on a Sunday, whereas the visiting company-owned East Coast fleets had no such scruples. The Lowestoft boats would land their fish on the Monday and get the best prices. When the local boats landed their fish on the Tuesday, the prices would be deflated. Newlyn and Penzance, as I say, were almost contiguous. But yet in 1795, Parliament gave leave for Newlyn to build a larger pier. But Penzance immediately counter-petitioned to prevent it. And for generations, this rivalry continued with the prosperous Penzance and the poorer relation Newlyn, almost like Devon and England and Cornwall. But the polarisation of the communities spilled into violence in 1896. And I've got some lovely quotes, like my great aunt was actually a teenager at the time of the riots. And luckily, when I was about 16, I recorded her talking about the riots. And she sort of said, Penzance and we never got on. And then she talked about how you know, her mother would never buy meat from a Penzance butcher. So the polarisation of the community spilled into violence when local fishermen boarded the Lowestoft boats, and a bit like the Boston Tea Party, they threw the mackerel overboard. 3 days of confrontation ensued, with the government sending down 330 redcoats from the Royal Berkshire Regiment to quell the riots, and three gunboats were stationed in Mounts Bay. And in fact, for 10 years afterwards, gunboats still patrolled Mounts Bay during the fishing season. One MP even asked if the government should introduce a measure for Cornwall along the lines of the Irish Coercion Bill. Yet rather than being a confrontation between Newlyn and Lowestoft, which it should have been, it turned into an excuse for Penzance to side with Lowestoft against Newlyn. And so the main confrontation was actually between the two Cornish communities. And we can see evidence of that type of rivalry still in Cornwall, sometimes at rugby matches, which people moving to Cornwall may find hard to understand. Recent research from the University of Greenwich has shown that fishing not only contributes economically to coastal communities, but also provides a range of broader social and cultural benefits, including the creation of a particular distinctiveness, sense of place, and identity focused on fishing, both contemporary and historic. And I think one of the things I want to come out of this talk is that I totally agree, as an engineer, I totally agree with new technologies and Cornwall embracing a vibrant economic future through innovation. But I think as well, we mustn't forget the traditional industries. And here in 1891, Newlyn was 60% fishing. All the occupations were to do with fishing, 60%. Whereas Penzance, a coastal community just up the road, 1.5% were involved in fishing. So this is Chapel Street. We had two Chapel Streets, one in Newlyn, one in Penzance, and this was Penzance. And you can see what a vibrant market economy it must have had. But there's one thing I noticed in the census. I was looking at the Madron Poorhouse, which is where Newlyn and Penzance people would have gone in times of trouble. And there's not a single fisherman. And it struck me that this fishing community was very family orientated. If somebody was in trouble, they would look after their kin. And the sad thing is, you've got general servants, 27 of them. And that was because when they became a servant, they lost their ties with their family to a large extent. And of course, if you had any illness like TB, you ended up in the poorhouse because you couldn't work as a domestic servant anymore. And in fact, my great aunt ended up at Bodmin Workhouse because of that. So I'm fast forward now to 2014. Get the notes again. Studying Newlyn has shown how important employment and trade is on sense of belonging, particularly one that is passed through the generations. However, with mass migration out of Cornwall over the last century and then mass in-migration, it is easy to see how identity and sense of belonging can be lost. So how can heritage help? Well, we know that festivals, historic buildings, culture and language can be enjoyed by everyone, and you don't necessarily have to be Cornish. Belonging to Cornwall, enjoying Cornwall is sufficient. We also know from the 2011 census and the Cornwall Quality of Life Survey that increasing numbers are actually identifying themselves as Cornish. And I was really annoyed by the Western Morning News this week because they said that there was Cornwall language was dying because there was only 564 people that spoke it. I thought, no, they got that from the 2011 census. And what it really is people who have identified themselves as primarily speaking Cornish. And there's a difference, isn't there? You know, I think a lot of people are really interested in the language and the culture now. Well, the heritage sector is a key driver for economic regeneration, and the Heritage Lottery Fund has estimated that over £26 billion has been contributed to the UK economy through heritage sector, and that international visitors are spending a lot more money in this country because of it. And I think with the new key hub, we're seeing a lot of German visitors coming in. They're high-end tourism. You've got the visitors from the USA, tracing their family history and so on. And so we've got a golden opportunity, I think, to market heritage. And one of the things we do in Cornwall Heritage Trust, as I said, we're really keen on education, because when people move down to Cornwall, their children need to learn about what it's like to be in Cornwall, what our background is. And this is Carn Uni, and it's St Just's School. We did this landmark travels project in conjunction with the Institute of Cornish Studies, and went into the school for a day teaching them about Iron Age Britain and lifestyle in Carn Uni. And then the children actually went for a day and did a project, and then the next day they went back to school and finished off their project. And the headmaster was absolutely thrilled with the work they did. And Iron Age, that was populated between about 500 BC and 400 AD. Oh, and if you haven't visited the Fogu there, you must. It's absolutely amazing. And this is Castle and Dynas, another one of our sites. Again, an Iron Age hill fort. And one thing we can share with the pupils is sort of drawings of what Iron Age life might have been like. And of course, Castle and Dynas was a major wolfram mine in the 50s. So again, another opportunity for the children to learn about geology and the traditional industries of Cornwall. We own Trefry Viaduct, and it's a blessing and a curse at the same time. We've just had estimates of £4 million to restore the viaduct. And there's a Heritage Lottery Fund bid going, well, in at the moment. We should hear any day now whether we've been successful. This was an amazing structure built by Joseph Trefry in between 1839 and 1842. And basically to get the China clay products from the clay sites to Par, where he built Par Harbour as well. And there's a water that goes, there's a leat as well as a tramway, and the leat powered the electricity and so to get the clay across. And the thing about the water, if you think about it, the engineering expertise to get the levels exactly right so that the water would flow in the right sort of amount is just unbelievable. And of course, it's where the past meets the future, because once we've got the leat flowing again, we can produce hydroelectricity. And so I think it's a lovely example of where, and also lovely for the children to learn. We did a community exercise. We went into the school, and the children tried to understand the problems that Trefry overcame. And then we had a day where the community mixed with the children. We had local musicians, the pub supplied pasties, and the children made bunting to go. Because in the Victorian days, the communities did come to just gaze at Trefry Viaduct. They came on trains just to have a picnic and look in amazement. And if you haven't been walked up the Luxellian Valley to see Trefry, you must. It's fantastic. And again, another iconic site, the Hurlers, which we manage, and another school visit. So the challenges for a sustainable future. I think Cornwall Council actually produced this report, but I thought it was excellent. It was "You Can't Eat the View," if you look in 2012, residents' gross annual earnings were only 84% of the UK average, with part-time work accounting for 41.5% of employment. And Sheffield University's recent research puts Cornwall nearly at the bottom of the UK in terms of the loneliness index. And so, although it's a beautiful place to live, and I absolutely have a whale of a time in Cornwall, for some people it's not quite the same. And we also need to look at population-led growth. In the Iron Age, there was a massive population increase, but that was because of new crops, new technology, and international trade. But for the decades, economists have tried to improve Cornwall's economy through population-led growth. But as Ronald Perry said in Cornish Studies in the 1990s, a lot of the people that came in were job takers rather than job makers. And we've got to make sure that our investment in renewables and so on creates jobs in Cornwall, not in Germany or Scandinavia, but in Cornwall. With people's livelihoods at stake, we do need to develop Cornwall both in terms of industry and housing, but this places enormous pressure on the heritage sector. Whilst accepting the need for development, we also need to work out how we can best protect our unique environment for future generations. Lou is not like this. Lou has a fantastic community atmosphere. But I've been working with another community on the north coast on a neighbourhood development plan, which I think, I agree with Edwina, these are a really fantastic opportunity for communities to engage and actually influence policy. They've got a historic village centre full of second homes. And I'm not going to get into the second home argument because, you know, for some people, you could argue that they maintained the fabric of the historic centre in a way that perhaps we wouldn't have done as locals. Around that village centre, a new build, and when I say new, it's sort of post-war, really, residence and holiday lets. And then around the estates, the kettling of the Cornish, as I call it, the estates and affordable housing. And what it's created is a polarisation of the community. And what we've seen with the Newlyn riots that there's an undercurrent of unrest. And when we analysed all the questionnaires that we got back, they generally, you know, lots of capitalisation about what they didn't like and things like that. Mainly issues on housing and planning. But also, the nice thing for us was that there were a lot of positive things about wanting to keep the culture and heritage. So, my final slide. Yeah, sorry. My final slide is what can we do to overcome the issues? And I think we need to look at local community policy at a micro level. Not just Cornwall, certainly not the whole of England. It's got to be at a community level, and that's why neighbourhood plans are great. We need to leverage education. We need to understand what heritage is and also its economic value and maximise community bond. And heritage champion bit was just about, I'll go and race now. We need to work in partnership as heritage organisations as much as we possibly can so that we come over as one voice for Cornwall. Thank you.
Oh, okay, right. Andrew Ormrod. I've just got a small thing to challenge the view that you can't eat the view. I went to a very interesting meeting in the Somerset Levels a few years ago where they had a project, which doesn't exist anymore, called Eat the View. The thing is about the landscape in Cornwall is that it's been shaped almost entirely by human activity. And part of the challenge is actually to combine farming and food production with the sort of natural resources and ecology of the area. And one of the things that sells products with the Made in Cornwall banner so strongly is the holidaymakers and other people's views of this green and pleasant land. And this is the really clever thing, is actually seeing, not maybe for mass-produced products, but for niche products, this combining of conservation of the Cornish landscape and production as well.
I totally agree with you. I think the purpose of this was that if you're unemployed and you're trying to keep a roof over your head, you're not going to be worried whether the Tristan stone gets moved for a car park or something. You're going to be concentrating on your own survival rather than, and that, as heritage organisations, you know, we're not a popular charity. Children's charities and cancer charities are far more popular than we are. We struggle to raise membership and things like that. And I think that's what I meant, but I totally agree with your point.